In this recession, we're looking at money a little differently. A bargain, getting things cheap, has become the all-consuming goal. Ellen Ruppel Schell has written a book entitled Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture. Your book tells the story of how we came to value cheap, but it also looks at the larger price we pay for cheap goods. What are some of those larger costs?
Well, that's a very, very big question, one that took me probably 3 years to untangle. The costs of low price involve a number of things. There's a tremendous amount of waste and a tremendous amount of transport costs and all sorts of things that occur when we proceed to force prices further and further down for commonly used consumer goods.
And societal costs as well.
Societal costs as well, yes. My argument is that the pursuit of low price, the race to the bottom, affects not only the people we think about, that is people working in the developing world making these goods, but also comes back to haunt us as well.
In your book, you talk about in the 19th century when mass production made what used to be luxuries cheaper. Critics called the cookie-cutter goods low-priced trash, ugly, short-lived abominations. Now, I can't imagine someone using that language today about what we find in the outlet malls or the big-box retailers, but in a lot of cases they could. How has our perception of value changed?
You know, that's so true. It's so funny when you look at this historically, which I did for a couple of the chapters in the book. And at one time, cheap goods were thought to make cheap men. That was the turn of the last century and maybe a little before that, of course, mostly men were working in these areas and not too many women. So there was this idea then that cheap stores, cheap goods would cheapen us in some way. And there was a big backlash through the 20s and the 30s after the onset of the so-called chain store. Prior to that, before the turn of the last century in the late 1800s and early 1900s, there was not a real prevalence of discounting. And that's because until about the turn of the last century, there was no such thing as a price tag. And, you know, that's a kind of a funny concept. There's a guy in Philadelphia by the name of John Wanamaker who owned the Wanamaker Empire of department stores, or grew to own those stores, who actually invented the price tag. And he also invented the sale. And he did so for good reason. He was a good religious man, and he felt that he needed to have sales to bring customers in after the Christmas rush to keep his employees working. Otherwise, people wouldn't come. He'd have to lay off employees, and he was very worried about that. So he instituted a sale, the first sales that we know about, to keep his employees working. And so for very good reason, he did that.
Those motivations, of course, have evolved a lot.
They certainly have. And in fact, he had a contemporary, not quite a contemporary, but someone who was around, their lives span certainly overlapped. And that was Frank Woolworth, that I think maybe many of your listeners have heard of, the Woolworth stores. Maybe some of them recall Woolworth stores here in the U.S., the five and dime, what we used to call a five and dime. Woolworth also was a discount. Woolworth was a kind of a discount king. But he changed. He kind of distorted what Wanamaker had in mind. His idea was to sort of scope the globe for the cheapest possible merchandise and to sell it as cheaply as possible. He put quality second, price first, and at the same time to achieve those low prices, he paid his workers very, very little. He mostly employed young women as clerks, $2 to $3 a week, which even in those days wasn't enough for them to live away from their parents. And he was quite almost proud of this. He said, you know, I can't have cheap merchandise without cheap help. These are cheap people, and if they don't like it, well, they should look elsewhere. So the Woolworth model is a little closer to the model that we have today, unfortunately. It could have gone either way. It could have gone the Wanamaker way, which resulted in yearly sales to benefit folks, or it could have gone in the Woolworth way, which is the way it went, where year-round low price drives down price, drives down wages and benefits for workers, and causes all sorts of fallout that we often don't anticipate.
You mentioned cheap goods make for cheap men. You quoted a labor scholar from the University of Illinois, Robert Bruno, who said, "We're creating low-income workers who become low-wage consumers who seek low-priced goods," which to my mind was like the whole idea of cheap goods make cheap men. Your book makes it sound as though we're in a spiral downward in pursuit of cheap goods. Why do you make that argument?
Well, I think it's a spiral we might now have the opportunity to pull ourselves out of. But yes, I do think it's a spiral. The idea that prices have to go lower and lower. And the reason for this, of course, is that since the 1970s, incomes in the United States have been essentially flat, controlling for inflation, and even going down somewhat for most Americans. Of course, this is not true of the extremely wealthy, but it's true of the majority of Americans. At the same time, the costs, our fixed costs, have escalated. And by fixed costs, I mean things like healthcare, transportation, education for our kids, taxes, mortgages, and childcare. All those things have, really, really increased in cost as our wages and benefits have stagnated, and also our job security. I think many of us are feeling that very strongly. So the price of consumer goods has gone down drastically since the 1970s. Most consumer goods, well, many of us think, the prices are high. Actually, they're quite a bit lower than they were at that time. But three-quarters of our income goes to pay for fixed costs, those things we can't live without, things I mentioned before, healthcare, education. And 1970, only one-half of our income went for those fixed costs. So we actually had a much more discretionary income in that time. So what have these low-price goods done for us? Well, I argue not a lot. It's made T-shirts and shorts and other things maybe cheaper than ever before, but we have sacrificed in terms of our wages, our job security, and our stability as an economy as a consequence of these increasingly low prices, this incredible, what we used to call predatory pricing.
My father used to say, "Good things aren't cheap. Cheap things aren't good." Now, I don't think he was thinking of the larger cost to society as your book outlines, but you end your book with a statement, "As individuals and as a nation, we can turn our attention to what matters, secure in the knowledge that what matters have never been and will never be cheap." Do you think people really think like that, or are they simply trying to make the budget, meet the budget for the month?
You know, a lot of people have asked me that. Do people really think like that? Well, I think that retailers and multinationals have gone really far to make us not think like that. And part of my motivation in writing Cheap was to kind of lift the veil on this issue. No, of course, none of us go to the store, very few of us, I should say. I certainly don't go to the store thinking about all the implications of what I buy. I do now, of course, but I certainly didn't when I began researching this book. But I also, in the book, I do a couple of chapters on pricing and the psychology of pricing. And I talk to readers about, you know, why is it that we're so bargain prone? Why is it that we're so attracted by discounts and by deals? If your father and your grandfather, I would assume as well, maybe your grandmother and mother as well, insisted on value, you know, there's an old Russian saying, I'm too poor to be cheap. You know, this is something that people used to take for granted. We used to know that we got what we paid for. Now, how did this common wisdom get forgotten in the current, economy? And the way that happened was through very deliberate marketing that involves a lot of psychology, a lot of brain power behind this. I went to a pricing conference where a whole room full of PhDs expounded on this. I talked to psychologists here and abroad on this issue, and also economists and neuroeconomists. I mean, people who really understand how the mind works. And they explained, and I hope I explained to readers, why it is that we've forgotten that you get what you pay for.
At the same time,
there's no accident.
At the same time, when I buy a pair of shoes and they're cheap enough, if they fall apart, I don't feel like I have to take and get them repaired. I can just throw them away. buy a new pair of shoes. I mean, most of the products we get, we throw away because they are so cheap. We don't have to worry about the cost of repairing them simply because we can replace them with something brand new.
Absolutely. And of course, that's disposability has been marketed to us as a big advantage. And I've also gotten that comment from folks. Well, you know, who cares? I'll just throw it away. I don't want something that lasts a long time. I want something new all the time. Well, I challenge that. People say that it's almost a kind of a defensiveness. It would mean that perhaps the heirloom chair they got from their parents was valueless to them, or the ring that was passed down from grandmother to granddaughter was valueless. I don't believe that. I think we have a natural concern about craftsmanship, about things lasting. Things that are of value are lasting to us. It doesn't mean you're going to hang on to the same shirt for 30 or 40 years, although maybe your father did or your grandfather did. It's possible. But it does mean that today our relationship with objects has really become distorted. I mean, the very idea that you would buy shoes knowing almost as you leave the store that they're not going to last. And studies show that if you believe that, you don't take care of them. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You assume they're going to fall apart. You just don't expect that much of those cheap shoes. So you don't take care of them. You don't really worry if they fall apart. And again, the retailers know that. They count on that because your churning of purchases is what helps their bottom line, because obviously those shoes are not made here and, you know, by American workers or by workers getting what we would consider a reasonable wage under reasonable conditions. Those shoes are made very, very cheaply and provide a huge profit to the stockholders and the executives at these companies. So this churning, as we all know, not only degrades our relationship to objects, but it also, of course, results in great environmental damage. And I deal with that in the book in the case of timber and forestry. I don't deal with it in every single aspect, but environment is a very important part of the book.
You spend a lot of time on that, talking about IKEA, which I think a lot of people would be surprised isn't the environmental champion that many people believe it is. I want to go on to one other thing. Many of us feel we can only afford cheap. What are you suggesting we do?
You know, I thought very carefully about that because being a deal-prone person myself and having kids myself and being a very budget-conscious myself, I didn't want it to make anything like an elite argument in this book. First of all, I believe that value, true value, is overpriced in the United States and for reason, that it's quite deliberately overpriced, that there's this false dichotomy between quality and price. I believe, and I think it's true, and I think I've established it, that quality can be had at a reasonable price. Things can last and be durable and be what we want, and it can be a reasonable price, not a luxury. Okay, so we'll start there. But when we go to the store, let's take an outlet store, for example. Most of us, on average, when we go to an outlet store, we spend about 80% more than we do in a traditional retail outlet, okay, a non-discount store. We spend about 80% more in a discount environment. Now, why is that? That is because when we're in a discount environment, especially an outlet mall, which means that the stores are branded, we get the brands which we assume are good quality because we link brand and quality. And then we're getting what we think are these amazing deals. And this triggers in our brain this kind of game playing behavior. We want to make all these, you know, we want to win. We get there. We see these things. We think they're too good to pass up. We don't want to miss the opportunity to get this great deal. So I think many of us, and I'll ask you if this has ever happened to you. It certainly used to happen to me. You come home from a discount mall or discount store. You have all these little plastic bags. You know, they use these little plastic bags lying around your entryway of your apartment or your home. And you go, why the heck did I buy all this stuff? What am I going to do with this stuff? I'm not necessarily even happy with this stuff. Then you often find a lot of the stuff isn't working for you. You know, the color on the clothing just doesn't really work for you. The size isn't quite right. The tool doesn't sit well in your hand. Whatever it is you're buying, oftentimes you find isn't what you expected it would be. And that is because, once again, you've grabbed that deal. You've gone – that deal-making behavior, that deal-making instinct has been triggered, and you've overbought. So my – another goal in writing this book was to get consumers to rethink why they shop in the first place. Do we go to buy things that are going to enhance our life and add value to our life, or is it an, is it a game-playing exercise? And I think most of us would say rationally, well, you know, look, I go to purchase things that are going to enhance my life. And if that's the case, I think that you will actually spend less money. You will buy fewer things, and you'll think harder about why you're buying those things, and you'll get precisely what you want at the price that's going to work for you. So this doesn't mean, you know, you're going to be buying high-end things. This might mean that you might go to a flea market, for example, to buy a bookshelf rather than buy a brand new spanking new bookshelf at a discount store made out of particle board. That isn't even really going to work for you, and certainly you're not going to be able to pass it down from parent to kid to kid to kid. You won't necessarily be able to resell a cheap discount store bookshelf. But if you get a good quality bookshelf secondhand, the chances are you can varnish the thing, you can polish the thing up. If it's solid wood, it'll work for you, it'll do the job you want, and you may even be able to resell it if you move, or you may be able to pass it down among your family members. So in fact, you're saving quite a bit of money doing that, and also obviously having a good environmental impact as well.
And your bookshelves won't sag from the weight of your books either, like they do with particle board.
Right.
Ellen Ruppel Schell is the author of the book Cheap, The High Cost of Discount Culture. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. It's been really fun.